Good morning, Mr. Chair. I was proposing that the fleet carry on and answer the remaining questions on this chapter. I have had a request from the author of the Arrowtown Management present to her Section 42A next. Two reasons. One, so that she might write to me today, but second, so that Ms. Lex can also have a look at the next chapter that she's going to present to you. I also have some responses to you, but I'll just propose to Ms. Lex finish her questionnaire on this chapter first.
That's fine. There's been an advance on the situation with Ms. Banks.
The situation is the same. I'm calling Ms. Banks on the other attendee screen today. She isn't at work. So what we were proposing to suggest was that Ms. Banks be available during a space in the hearing next week.
The week after next.
Is it the week after next?
Yes, 26th of October, I think.
Which I think is
Wednesday, yes.
Yes. I understand there's some time frame this afternoon where Ms. Banks could answer any presenter summary and answer any questions from the panel. Possibly a better way forward than Ms. Lee's endeavouring to answer your questions on this chapter. I could, or Ms. Lee could also read out a summary so that you have heard that today, if that was panel.
We've already pre-read out, so I don't think we need to have it read out. I think probably better to hear that from Ms. Lee's at the appropriate time.
Yes, thank you for your indulgence.
That's okay. Let the banks know that the panel is hoping that she can get the same as well.
We'll pass that on, thank you.
Ms. Leaf, now, I was at the point where I was going to ask you questions on the revised Chapter 7 that you attached to your Section 43 report. The first question I've got is in relation to policy, and I'll use the new number you have now, so make it easier. 7.2.1.2. I'm just wondering whether the plan actually requires a specified intensity.
No. Well, in some of the areas that have been identified, such as the Eden's boundary and out of control boundary and Queenstown Pike, there is an intensity which is preset, but for the remainder of the zones, you've got the 450 base density, which
and then the 300, so there will be there. Are the, from memory, the policies relating to the airport, I'm not sure about Queenstown Hill Heights, but I'm just wondering whether this policy is more directed than maybe it should be in, given your answer, you're suggesting there's flexibility here. I don't know what's characteristic to alter that, but it probably is in the general sense that the advice we've had that they have to match the rules.
I think there is scope to change that because the word requires compromise.
My amendments are a little bit more. Right. Yeah. Okay. Now, objective 7.2.2. And I suppose the first question I have is this term gentle density something that is going to run?
I've got to admit it's not a term that I'm particularly warm to. It's been described to me as like density with a warm hug. I think it's something that I adopted out of the Section 32 report, because that's where the intent came from, and I noticed that one of the submitters, I forget who now, has said in their research-related evidence that it doesn't really mean anything that will be lost, and I do accept that and think that that could be changed.
Okay. I think it would be helpful if we had a term that is readily understandable, even if it's just density. The other question I've got on that objective is, you've added the phrase at the end in response to QAC. Is that an environmental outcome?
I consider that it is an environmental outcome because it's saying what the density is within those areas.
Is there potential for it to be more generalised and pick up Queenstown Heights?
Yes, absolutely.
But I was thinking in terms of the objective, and then this policy will specify the exception. That might be when I was thinking in the long term.
Yeah, I understand.
With policy 7.2.2.1, I know that the last bullet point there is relevant specifically to that, but is that the only intended use of the screen activation issue?
Street activation and passive surveillance and all those kinds of things that come with those items.
Well, I'm just wondering because it's not, it doesn't seem to me to be provided elsewhere in the objectives and policies, but the rules and assessment criteria for various things relate to it. I just wondered if that was an oversight or. And you probably can't answer that, so you didn't write the preference of looking
at it. And it's something that I've picked up through the submissions and tried to retrofit in places. And I'm not sure whether there's a scope to do it, but I can take a look.
Okay.
Yeah.
Then you've suggested deleting objective 7.2.4. And that objective, as an insight, appears to me to be relating to the feeling where we have input. I'm wondering whether everything that's contained in it has been packed up above, or have we lost something?
I found the reason why I deleted that objective was because I just think that all of the matters have been addressed elsewhere. In terms of low rise, we've got height and other policies. And then the objective 7.2.2 addresses the infill housing. And then the new policy 7.2.2.4 talks about diversity and affordable residential accommodation.
The next policy, 7.2.2.3, is that relating only to the infill density, or is that intended to be a broader application policy?
This one was intended to be the gentle density, the 5.5.
That's okay, that's sort of clarifying. The next issue I have is objective 7.2.4, the new 7.2.4. As I read that objective, it's saying that community activities should be in residential areas in preference. Is that what was intended?
Yes, I think that community activities are most often best located in the residential areas that they serve. For the connection to the community, walking, for example, schools and doctor's visits and things like that. So they do have a place in town centres, but.
That's why I'm just wondering if there's unforeseen consequences of saying that you can focus on residential areas with some of the more commercial focus community activities, if you like. Even fire stations are probably better located than commercial area on the edge, but in the middle of the residential area, notwithstanding fire services. And if you look at the existing Frankton, the location of it ended up in the wrong place because it's in the middle of the residential area, so that needs to move.
I think given that there's the raft of activities encompassed by the community activity definition, there's definitely some that you want to see in the residential areas, but there's perhaps some that are not as well placed, because you know the definition includes things such as detention centres. I don't anticipate that Queensland's going to get one of those in a hurry, but we wouldn't necessarily want to see that in the residential zone. So yeah, I take what you're saying.
Is the intention of the objective that those community activities which are serving the needs of local residents should locate in that area of preference? Is that the intention you're trying to convey?
Yes, and I think words along those lines would probably be quite favourable.
Yeah. Just on that objective thing, the new words added were adverse effects on residential amenity are managed. Was there any particular type of management or degree of management that was sought? I'm just thinking through in light of the proposal for New Zealand's biggest detention centre. It says we planted a tree in front, therefore we have managed our effects, therefore we passed the objective.
True.
So I wonder whether what you were reaching for was something along the lines of well, it's about compatibility, isn't it? When you look at the policies, they talk about the scale, they talk about the amenity. And I think the scale is really the key issue, as I see what you've been responding to the chair about too, in terms of even a childcare centre. Looking after 10 students in a house-shaped building might be different to dealing with 150 children in what looks like a factory.
Yeah, that's right.
So, turning the observation into a question might be a good thing to do. So, maybe you could explain to me what those words were adverse effects on residential amenity are managed, what it was you had in mind in terms of what that objective should actually be achieving.
I think your original observations, right, it was trying to turn the objective actually into an objective, and I've used the word managed, but perhaps is a better word to address compatibility.
Policy 7251, it says that it's to optimise the efficiency and safety, but I'm not sure, can you explain the efficiency and safety of what? Objective 7.2.6. Do you think that could be turned into something more positive?
Absolutely.
And because it seemed to me that the Section 32A, or the Section 32 report, was suggesting the value of small scale commercial, that sort of conveys it as an alternative, but I'm not sure that it's quite, it could be more positive for small scale ones and discouraging the other ones like this thing.
Yeah,
that would fit better with the policies that follow from it, I suspect. was confused about what this is trying to do, and I'm wondering if it's really trying to say that where other activities are more important than the residential use, the residential activities have to be designed to mitigate reverse sensitivity effects. Is that what it's trying to say?
Yes,
bring
between your
lines,
I think that's what it's
about. Because it's pretty obscure, isn't it?
It is.
It seems to me that if that objective, you might like to consider whether 7.2 and the exception to it could be better dealt with by making that objective clearer.
Sorry, just to clarify, so
7.2. I asked you about 7.2 and the exception, you know, excluding the noise boundary out of control boundary from that piece, but whether this objective is actually trying to do that just in such a way that no one understood it. Now, in the last policy in that group, 7.3, do you think it's appropriate to specify within the policy the 80 metres, given Dr. Child's suggestion that there should be different distances in certain locations in the rule as sought by NZTA, also sought different distances?
Yeah, I can look at amending that in line with what Dr. Child has recommended. The 80 metres originally came from the NZTA submission, but yeah, looking at it further in the specific areas that might have to be, yeah, we can make that more general.
Now, rule 7.4.4 is in the building restriction areas. Is that actually an activity or is it a standard?
It's a standard.
So it should move its table to it.
That's it.
Yeah. Now, 7.6. Given that the objectives and policies are focused on small commercial centres, how does rule 7.4.6 give effect to that?
Yeah, well, with the changes to the policy, the policy, policy 7.2.6.2 originally had the 100 square metres or the gross floor area in it, and that's where we perhaps deleting that out of the policy could involve a change to that rule about the smaller scale being
Is there a possibility of having two activity types? I'm just concerned that a non-complying activity would mean that some smaller activities will find it prohibitive.
Yeah, I
did that. I think that's what I And this is more of a drafting thing. I'm just wondering whether the standards could actually be with other standards rather than in the activity. In rule 7.5.2, and this actually goes through all the residential zones, in reference to sloping site in the stock, and notes definition of interpretation of building height, and then it says how ground slope is measured. Should sloping site be a defined term so that it's easier for users to know that every time they see slope and site it means the same thing?
Yes, it should. I'm trying to remember. Ms. Banks and I had a big conversation about this and I can't remember where we got to with that, I'm sorry. Yeah, it's in the current definition, in the Oxford District Plan definition of either building height or ground level, and we thought that it needed to also say that. I'll have to do some research and figure out where we got to with that, but I do think it needs to be a defined term in some capacity to make it consistent throughout the plan.
I doubt that this, given that it is defined in the rules, I doubt that this needs the scope to improve the chapter 2. Could you make a matter of being clear? So, rules 754 and 755, I'm just wondering whether they can't be combined. There doesn't seem to be any difference in the effect when you're within the air noise boundary or the air control boundary. I might be wrong.
I was trying to thought the same thing and then found that they were different. But now you've got me. can't.
But maybe it's easier if you, maybe if you can answer that one in reply. But the other question I've got is, on that one is, it refers to the 2037 noise contours. From a plan user, how would they know what they are? That's probably what's in the option.
Yeah, some of those provisions are not particularly
Rule 757. Could you explain why non-compliance, the Landsat permeable surface coverage is non-compliant in this zone, but restricted discretion in medium density?
In medium density, it was a submission to change it if I took the opportunity. For low density,
right. There
hasn't been a submission to that yet.
Now, rule 75.96, and I know there's probably no submission on this one either. There might be some whole plan submission that could be used for these circumstances. I'm wondering what this requirement relates to. In terms of the provision of too many space for too many buildings, is that something that's required in Queenstown?
That's Queenstown's bit, but not one of it.
That's right.
Oh, I see.
Mm-hmm. The reason I asked the question is I measured up how much space our covered into recycling bins take, and it takes up 0.7 of a square metre. and that area, I suspect, is more than that. So I'm wondering whether it's appropriate to have a different light rule or to have a more generalised.
To
change
the provision and the low density residential. I didn't mention that the provisions were possibly interfered within the amount of land area and site coverage requirements and the like, but
I just
again
just give
us permission to
hear
of it, but I can look for a whole
plan once, if you'd like. You might have to have a discussion with the Scott about the appropriateness of that one, but then you know you're like.
No, it's a conservative point of view.
I know there's probably no submission on this. Although Forreston did. 75.414, the setback from water bodies, and it's the same in the other zones. I'm just wondering why it's 7 metres in the estimate provision requirements of 20 metres. So,
I don't know.
The other one I have is on 7516, which is the hyperscription as well, Frankton Road. And it's more of a comment than a question. I'm just wondering whether that area should be marked on the town maps. It comes up in the wisdom tool. Rules, I think. And rather than having to find a paper road and lot 1 DP 12665, but as soon as that subdivide will cease to be findable.
Yeah, I think it's useful.
And then the reference in various places could just be who is on the planning map.
Just a question. I guess it's a question, but it's a bit of an open-ended question. The approach that's been taken, and of course this is the first one of these particular hearings I've participated in, unlike at least the chair. But the approach taken to things like the scope of submissions is extraordinarily well-disciplined and tight. Every other plan change, whether it's a topic or a whole plan I've ever seen, there's at least one submission calling for something like scrap all the rules, let me do what I like, that opens doorways to all sorts of editorialising scope to deal with why there's a rule requiring a tiny UX storage space in a low density zone but not a rule requiring an outdoor garden at the plan, which seems strange. And I guess it's a question seeking some reassurance that amongst all the submissions and further submissions, this process uniquely doesn't have any of those more general type submissions that, while not targeting a specific word and a specific rule or a specific policy, are sufficiently clear in their intent that the scope to do things like tweaking the location of some of the policies that maybe sit in the wrong objectives or things like waste storage rules that maybe by your own account are not necessary. Are we that clear that there's such a strict discipline in the submissions that we don't have that kind of wiggle room? Anyone?
I can answer that. In terms of your question, as in to the extent of the location of policies, that is certainly not opposed. In terms of the scope to relocate the objectives and policies and recommendations like that have been made in the session 42A reports before you. There also are, as the chair alluded to, some all of plan submissions, which the one I'm thinking of essentially says we want not a district plan, not a proposed district plan. So that does open up some scope. It doesn't open it up in its entirety, but it opens up between those two points. But this is the submissions that we've given the panel is also the matter of natural justice and fairness in terms of whether such changes would be anticipated by those all of plan submissions. And that needs to be considered on a case-by-case basis. But there are, and I mentioned this in the opening submission, that the council officers have endeavoured to provide additional recommendations and changes where, in their view, there's no change to the substance or regulatory effect of the submission and the council submission, that is okay. And those changes can be recommended by the panel.
Just on the issue of fairness and natural justice, if there was, I haven't looked at the whole plan submission, so I don't know what they will say. But if there were to be a whole plan submission that says, you know, we could remove the walls or deregularize or something like that, removing the wall or lessening the impact of the wall wouldn't be breaching their expectations, would it? There wouldn't really be an actual justice issue there.
Not that that particular submitter's expectations, but whether anyone else who picked up the entire suite of submissions and read them, including that particular submission, could anticipate that that would be the type of change that would result from that submission. That's the question that really needs to be asked. The one submission I was thinking of is actually not all the same. I think it only relates to the rule.
Yes, and it has been very helpful in the rural.
And I'm not sure if that was more explicit. I'm referring to that explicit. That was more explicit related to the rural zones only, whereas some other commission that might be all of stage one needs to be treated with some more care. That's not to say that they can't be used in some instances, but we would like to consider those changes that have been made. That's not some of the questions you're asking about some of these.
I understand all that. No, look, the question I asked came from my reflection on the conversation about Rule 757 about the landscape surface and it being non-compliant, and the answer was, well, there wasn't a submission, so it stays. And to be honest, I was expecting you were ready with some answer about it's essential to have the open space and an identity zone because it's about detached dwellings and it's a really key thing of implementing your proposed objective about requiring intensity. So it's not what your view was. Your view was there wasn't a submission, which seemed to be a bizarre state of affairs, if that really is the case. That we were to stick with something that the reporting planner herself suggests might be the OTT. So that's where that question was coming from anyway. So that's helpful. So maybe when you guys are just doing your wrap-up and review as part of your own response to us, you might, in response to this conversation, just have a quick think yourself about the nature of some of those submissions that might or might not exist to help us frame where we might go.
Yes, we appreciate that.
Okay.
That question and that.
I think what I could add, Ms. Scott, is in my experience, and I'm sure Munro's similar experience, that a lot of these simple bulk location standards, in most plans around the country, it's a restricted discretionary activity to breach them, certainly to a certain extent. Sometimes they'll say so much and then discretionary and non-complying, but to have non-complying for a simple breach of landscaping, or even a side yard, you know, setbacks, but and some of them just seem extraordinarily restrictive for what the matter that's been dealt with. And I think we're not going to achieve the purpose of getting more housing in the district if we have restrictive, rigorous set standards. And don't allow innovation, essentially.
Yes, it's understood. As she's heard from Miss Lee, she didn't draft the chapter, so she is.
Yes, I understand the difficulty that Miss
Lee has been. You know, that's ruined it, so.
I don't think anyone else has found it. Well, thank you, Miss Lee. Very helpful. I'm sure you'll be helpful again in the meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I just may respond to the question from Mr. Munro about the visitor accommodation situation. You essentially asked whether there was, whether the provisions in terms of the pullback blanket provision provided scope for submissions of visitor accommodation activity. In short, the answer to that is yes, it does. So I think your question came up through the paragraph of Ms. Clegg's section 42A that she corrected. So there were these visitor accommodation provisions that were notified in stage one and then were withdrawn. So no submissions would have been made at that time asking for the fallback rule to be relaxed because there were actually specific activity rules. Slightly different is the visitor accommodation subzone. They were not notified in stage one and the intention was and still is that they were notified in stage two. So if an activity, whether it's visitor accommodation or anything else, isn't provided for in the residential zone and isn't listed as specifically permitted, then we can seek consent for it. And the current format is not compliant. And the issue was probably for the panel on making recommendations is how you might seek to provide visitor accommodation. We expect that this scope to consider visitor accommodation when you're looking at that default status, which in this limit cannot be prohibited in 2.6, because it's specifically prohibited. But I also add to that it is a relevant consideration that the council has set in evidence that it is looking to notify that in stage two. I expect that there's no certainty to you as the recommendator that there is no certainty as to what they...
Would you call us the recommendators?
Sorry, the panel are making its recommendation.
Sorry, I felt uniquely important for it there.
You have all the control here. In making recommendations that the council is looking to notify them in stage two, but of course there's no certainty as to what they are.
Look, that's really helpful. My lack of clarity was whether the council had sought to withdraw only the particular provisions that it had written about visitor accommodation, or whether it was actually trying to withdraw the fundamental activity of visitor accommodation from the plan. And you've helped me very much.
Not at all.
That's
not the council. The council is very aware that it's a very important issue for the district, and it wants essentially, in short, to do a better job of it through stage two.
Sure. Okay, thanks.
So if we can turn to Ms. Law, and she will present her summary of the evidence and the answering questions.
So my name is Rachel Law, I'm a policy planner for council. The Arizona Residential Historic Management Zone covers the older part of the residential settlement of Arizona surrounding the town center. The area has a distinctive character and development pattern which is thought to be protected and maintained. The provisions for the zone effectively replicate those in the Oxford District Plan. The structure of the redrafted Arizona Residential Historic Management Zone remains largely the same as the notified version, other than the non-substantive amendments for improved clarity. The recommended non-substantive changes in this chapter include amendments to the matters of discretion in the notified and redrafted rules 10.4.4, 10.5.5, and 10.5.6, and minor work changing to the policies and objectives to ensure that they are written as such. I recommended some changes to the definition of minor alterations and additions to the wording, relating to removing the contradictory wording in the first bullet point in relation to timber stain, and the unnecessary last sentence of prevention. In relation to the submission and evidence from the New Zealand Fire Service, which I know it relates to all fire service chapters, I wish to hear Minister Clark speak before panel before making a recommendation on whether to accept or reject the reading thought. The minimum lot standard in the subdivision chapter for the zone is 800 meters squared. No submissions have thought that it be changed.
Yes, thank you. I don't have any questions of the 42A report, but in terms of the attachment one, appendix one, sorry, to that report, I do have some questions about the proposed provisions. I understand the restricted discretionary approach for buildings. But what I'm not quite clear on is we have 10.4.2 residential unit permitted, but that's not talking about the building, which was captured elsewhere, that's talking about residential activity. But I wonder whether residential unit is a confusing thing to put in, because I think people think of a residential unit as a building, but it's not intended to be permitted.
Mm-hmm.
Is it?
No.
Or am I not that wrong?
The building is not intended to be
right.
Permitted.
Okay, so so the 10.4.2, then we go to 10.4.4, construction of or alteration of buildings, understood. Discretionary. I wasn't clear why, in terms of those restrictions, the last bullet, consideration shall be guided by the Arrowtown design guidelines. Would it not be more direct just to say one of the matters of discretion is consistency with the guidelines, or implementing the guidelines, or being in some way actually you have to meet the guidelines, not use the guidelines to help you meet something else?
Potentially, it should be a bit more precise. I think considerations was put down so that you would read, there's a lot of things covered
sure.
in the design guidelines that may or may not apply.
Right. I mean, I think I go back to the policies that the rule lives under, and it's 10.2.1.2, and it says ensure that buildings are designed and located in a manner, etc., etc., that is consistent with the outcome sought by the design guidelines. So that doesn't say use the design guidelines to guide assessment, it says development should be consistent with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was expecting in the first instance that the restrictions would include that, but okay. But I understand that. And I understand the minor alterations of additions clause. Should there be, if I owned a house that had a window and I wanted to get more light at the window, so I replicated that window four more times, one next to the other, to substantially open up and change at the start pretty substantially, that would qualify as a minor permitted exclusion, would it, in terms of the doors and windows requirement? There's no limit on how many doors or windows or their size, it's just as long as they kind of fit in with the existing pattern, is that right?
As long as they fit in with the existing pattern. But in terms of windows, it does say
at
the same profile
terms
of external
reveal depth. Yeah, so as long as I copied that one window, I could put another one next to it, then another one next to that, then another one next to that, presumably.
Presumably, I don't believe that would be the intent, that you could change the wall to the
complete window. No, so I'm asking you whether in fact the rules would allow that as a permitted activity, which might kind of self-defeat the restricted discretionary intent.
Believe
that that's not the intent, okay. But that could be added. Okay. Could potentially be amended. Yep, and then we've got restricted discretionary activity for buildings, including all aspects of external light appearance are arranged by the matters. We then have in 10.5.5 road boundary setbacks, where if one complies with those yard setbacks, the building needs a restricted discretionary activity, and if one contravenes these setbacks, they still need a restricted discretionary activity. In any event, whether one complies or not, external appearance and everything about what it looks like is up for grabs. consistency with historic character and pattern of existing buildings, etc., in Arrowtown. It's interesting, but it doesn't seem to be a restriction that actually applies to buildings that do comply with the art setbacks, although maybe that would have made sense if it did. And that repeats likewise for the side and rear boundary setbacks. So I can't help but wonder whether a more efficient approach would just be to not have those setback requirements, but just put them as matters of discretion for the placement of buildings, which needs a thorough restrictive discretionary consent, looking at all things to do with size, scale, shape, colour, compatibility fit, and an additional bullet could be an appropriate side or appropriate boundary setbacks. I'm just trying to think through what we achieve by having a whole bunch of rules that lead you to fundamentally the same assessment, regardless of whether you comply or not, in which case why would I bother complying in the first instance if I could get an extra $50,000 worth of floor space on my commercial activity at the bottom of my site or something like that?
I would be kind of aggrieved. Again, I'm not sure if I have the scope to move those into.
No, let's not have that conversation here. And the last question I have, I think it's one the chair's going to raise, was one yesterday that came up yesterday about the minimum lot size and the density in terms of that historic area seems, to my possibly slightly trained eye, to be more consistently denser than those requirements. But I'm sure there'll be some analysis talking about average site sizes in that area rather than use the basal rule on. Or well, I mean, are you of the view that the density and lot area requirements are effectively matching what's there now, or not?
Lots there at the moment are pretty consistent with
this site. Okay. Okay, well, thank you. That's enough. Thank you.
Unfortunately, I did not get unless I start recording that of that. I'm working a little bit in the dark here. I've been through what I've got, which is the material regarding the monitoring report that I've got. But apart from that, I haven't got the other things. I did have.
Do you have two copies?
So
what's it that
you're missing? Well, I wouldn't mind a look at a copy.
Would you like to have the opportunity to look at
that as
a
morning
agenda?
Morning, great, because I did have a query regarding the guidelines and the group that administers the guidelines, if you like, which up until now has been a panel, and they seem to have fairly tight interpretation of the guidelines for some things that come into it, like what kind of roses you can take in the front car, whether there's anything that goes down that track in this material, I don't know.
That might be more on the guidelines that we're dealing with at the end.
It is
rather than these provisions. But probably worth your while having a look at those over the long term.
Is there anything the plan that talks about the administration of those guidelines? That's a concern that I would have at the moment. Yeah.
Just send them and we'll get you a copy. In the meantime, I'll ask you some questions. The only questions I have are actually on the list. Just on rule 10.4.3, and this is something from the sleep as well. I'm just wondering why, and I'm not saying it's wrong, but I'm just wondering why home occupations in the Arrowtown zone have no restrictions on them when they do the other residential zone. And whether that was intentional, or whether the other zones are wrong.
will confer with Ms. Lee to get back to you on that one.
Rule 10.4.9. Is that an activity or is that a standard?
I believe that's standard.
And then rule 10.4.12. And it says retail comprises up to 10% of the gross floor area. Is it meaning no more than the gross floor area?
Only that stage is here.
Okay. And then in 10.4.15, I'm wondering about the matter of discretion, the last matter of discretion listed there, and whether that is truly relevant given the licensing situation we now have. Now 10.5.3. I realise this has probably just been copied from the Oxford plan, but it has, it just highlights the problems with the Oxford plan. Is ground, the maximum ground floor area, is that actually the same as building coverage? Final point relates to 10.6.1, which is, says that applications for control activities not require a written consent to anyone. There are no control activities in the zone. I'm just wondering if that is an error and it should be something else. Well, it would be helpful if you were to wait until after the morning journey. If you gather up, there's any questions, obviously. And then, otherwise, in the meantime, I don't think we have any further questions. Okay.
So, a summary for the residential zone is the purpose of the residential zone is to provide for an increased density of housing in locations that are supported by appropriate infrastructure. A limited range of non-reconstructives are also anticipated where these enhanced residential amenity will support an adjoining town centre but do not impact on the primary role of the zone's carbon supply. I've recommended a number of minor and also more substantive changes to the medium-density residential sector as a result of the submission of the state. The most significant amendments recommended include deletion of the home star density incentive, the requirement to undertake sustainable design and 5-year sunset clause for increased density, application of a base density of 250 square metres and a 400 square metre maximum density for the greenfield medium-density residential area. Rationalisation and simplification of the urban design related objectives and policies. Removal of reference to reduce car parking requirements for developments within the medium-density zone. Identification of a new Arrowtown Historic Management Transition overlay area to allow the application of a new rule which requires consent for all new residential units within the overlay area, with consideration of the Arrowtown design guidelines as a matter of discretion. New but form controls to ensure views from the walkway and square heights are maintained. Extension of setback or acoustic insulation and ventilation requirements for all properties within 80 metres of the state highway. A change to recession plans only being applicable to flat sites as well as accessory buildings on all sites. A relaxation of the activity status for breaches of the landscape permeable surface rule from non-compliant to restricted discretionary. Multiple changes to boundary setback requirements to require greater setbacks for garages and state highways. Increase to the permitted building standard and removal of the reversal of pipe rule. The panel has deferred consideration of a number of provisions in the submissions on them to hearings on mapping upon receipt of those submitted. Those provisions specifically transferred as a whole to the mapping hearing are relating to the Frankston Medium Density Residential Zone, redrafted objective 8.2.9 and related policies 8.2.9.1 through to 8.2.9.7, rule 8.4.11.3, 4.6, Rule 8.5.3 and Rule 8.5.5.2. As a result of the deferral of submission points, the following sections of Section 42A evidence are no longer of relevance to this hearing. Paragraphs 10.27 to 10.28 relating to the Wanaka Town Centre Transition Overlay Area. Paragraphs 9.53 to 9.54, except as they still relate to square heights. 12.16, there's many paragraphs here, I'll let you read this, all relating to the Frankton Medium Density Residential Zone. Having read the evidence filed by Mr. McCall on behalf of the NZTA, I accept that the note under policy 8.2.11.6 could be retained subject to the amendments suggested by the submitter and with additional wording identifying the consultation being undertaken in capacity for road control and growth of the state highway. In relation to Mr. McCall's evidence regarding policy 8.2.11.3, I wish to hear the presentation before I come to a beyond the centre. I also wish to hear the presentation of Mr. Williams on behalf of Universal Development Limited in relation to the proposed height and setback rules for development adjacent to designation 270 before forming the view. Given the submitted facts that subdivision design has already been advanced, I'd like the submitter to consider whether retention of views could occur through imposition of development controls for only a portion of the walkway. I would also like to hear the presentation of Mr. Williams in relation to redrafted rules 8.5.5.2 and 27.6.1 relating to minimum density and maximum lot size. At present, I'm not persuaded by the evidence received to alter my recommendation. And I would also like the alternative minimum density and maximum lot size to be considered by the submitter. in relation to the changes proposed in policy 8.2.2.3 and rule 8.5.8.1b, but Mr. Williams is evidence. I consider that there may be merit to these changes, subject to a change to policy 8.2.2.3 to include the design of the garage as a consideration. So if I wish to hear the presentation, be submitted prior to finalising the position. Having read the evidence filed by Ms. Rennie on behalf of the Estate of Horton & Krebs and the Wiser Trust, I accept that further modifications to redraft the rule 8.5.4, the building coverage, should be recommended. Furthermore, I wish to give a presentation in relation to further changes to the activity status of the built form control for 4 years. I also note that Ms. Rennie's evidence proposing to use assessment matters which are not currently utilised within the residential chapters, with the approach instead being to include both broad and fine-grained policies to guide outcomes. I currently on this matter that the activity status should be retained as non-complying under the restricted discretionary for a range of assessment matters. I question the added value of the related book. I wish to hear the presentation of Ms. Hutton on behalf of the Otago Foundation Trust Board before forming a view on the proposed restricted discretionary activity status for community activities, particularly because of the wide range of activities that fall within the definition of community activities. Having read the evidence of Mr. Greaves on behalf of Steve Barton, Plaza Investments Limited and Verena Proprietary Limited, I do not support the proposed change to policy 8.2.2.2. As even with site constraints such as topography, I consider that inclusion of any or a combination of features such as low profile fencing, windows and landscape and the like is not right now. Would you like me to read the
section
of the
subdivision
again?
You can just go on to the details on the subdivision rather than up the ones that the must.
Okay. So if we look at the general minimum lot area, that the notified rule 15.5.1, notified rule, this rule specifies the minimum lot area is 250 square metres. And a number of submissions all support this minimum lot size. However, the Monica Residents Association Incorporated are concerned that the proposed density is incompatible with the stated goals of retaining amenity, including connections with the street, appropriate height and scale, access to sunlight and privacy. Paragraphs 9.42 to 9.52 of the Section 42A report addresses the minimum net site area for the medium density zone. And I consider that the same opinions are also applicable to the minimum lot area with the notified rule 22.5.1. As mentioned in my Section 42A report, Mr. Falconer has recommended a density range of between 150 to 350 square metres, however, I've recommended retention of the 250 square metre minimum net site area and a change to the activity status to discretionary. I do, however, note in paragraph 9.52 of the Section 42 report that this results in an inconsistency in activity status between chapters 8 and 27. With the development of minimum net site areas of least, the 250 square metres being discretionary under chapter 8, and subdivision involving less than 250 square metre lots being non-compliant. I consider that there is merit in this approach given the smaller lot sizes proposed and more certainty in the outcomes of providing where a site is developed first, or at least approved by a resource consent, and subdivided after. As a result, I support the notified 250 square metre minimum lot area for the zone. Paragraphs 9.53 to 9.54 of the Section 42A report addresses the maximum net site area and minimum site density. I recommend this for the zone for medium density location, but safe and secure height. All of the submissions relating to this matter have been considered as part of the Section 42A report and correct in the UGC zone and registered for the zoning hearing. In relation to the minimum zone mentioned and the notified rule 27.5.1.2, there's a number of submissions from the Hamilton family, that all support this rule. And I know that Mr. Nigel Bright and his wife of Fire Chapter 27 relocated this provision within the chapter. However, it didn't amend its content. I accept the commission's point. For the infill subdivision rule, 27.5.2.1, a number of submitters have also submitted seeking that none of this notified rule be retained. Conversely, Kunami Bodies Corporate and Forum Survey Consultants have sought installation. Mr. Bryson is evidence in relation to Chapter 27 has amended the notified rule in response to submissions to make it more practical. I concur with this change and consider that it does not affect the intent of the rule, which the committee seeks to retain. Consequently, I support the redraft rule. In conclusion, I support the minimum lot area notified and redrafted rule 27.6.1, and I've recommended the addition of a maximum lot area for greenfield areas of the zone, as outlined in my appendix 1. In addition, I support the notified rule 27.5.2.1 as it relates to the medium density residential zone, as recommended by Mr. Bryson, so it requires Chapter 27.
Thank you. Ms. Lee, just a general question to start. You were here yesterday when we asked questions respectively of Mr. Osborne and Mr. Falconer. And without putting words in their mouths, I was left with a sense from both of them that if, notwithstanding they indicated their own views might actually be a bit more aggressive from the intensity of growth than has come through to date, and they might come back and clarify that. But I think it is safe to say that they seem to have a view that if the panel came to the point where it agreed with submission suggesting greater provision should be made for development opportunity, the medium density housing zone would be a very, very good candidate to do that. And so just reflecting on anything that you've heard through that conversation, was there anything that you wanted to add to your recommendations about the rules in this particular chapter at this point?
I think that the zone as notified was a balance of trying to get the new zone in as well as trying to appease the community that, Wanaka in particular, Arrowtown as well, were quite, the community and the consultation phase were quite vehemently against the zone. And I think that that's where a lot of the standards and rules have come from, is promoting it, but also retaining community character and all those kind of things. Now, listening to the evidence provided yesterday, I think that yes, on purely economic grounds, that you would definitely want to try and maximise design, and same in terms of urban design, but we have to balance that. Also, in thinking about it overnight, I think there possibly is some ground to make it more, less restrictive in terms of the activity status of the number of the provisions, and that's why I'm quite interested to listen to the submitters, Ms. Rennie, on behalf of the Estate of Norman Press and the Wanaka Trust next week, a week after, or even tomorrow,
Yeah,
listen to what they have to say and perhaps
reflect
on that some more.
Yes, that issue of balancing. There's a certain point where things are so balanced that the zone can't achieve so much of what it was set out to do that there's an issue with the plan. And appreciating your comments about Council's document of opposition by some in the community, possibly a lot, but But if I look through the zone purpose, it seems to put a lot more emphasis on addressing Queenstown's growth and development and affordability issues than keeping the existing locals happy, to phrase it bluntly. It does talk about maintaining amenity. And if we go through the objectives and policies, the first one says immediate density housing occurs in these locations. It doesn't say opportunistically through the district where it fits in when people are happy, which is one way of pepper potting density, if you like, accepting a balance between people that don't want change and providing change. The plan's very directive. These locations are the right ones and it should happen here in a way that effectively softens impacts on neighbours. So that's what I've read from the objectives and policies. So it seems to me the balance, as you describe, doesn't seem to be, if you conceptually sort of see it as an even flat line, it seems very heavily tilted towards enabling growth and development in that zone. Have I got that right, or am I not reading the provisions right?
I think you are right in terms of those provisions, but then you've also, things have been tempered by Mr. Felton's evidence saying two story is not really realising the medium density zone, and that our provisions are limiting things to two stories. And so I think that that's, I get where the balance is coming in. But I do take it, and we do have an issue. Mr. Osborne presented yesterday, we've got an issue with both housing availability and affordability. So there is a need to promote it.
And then as I see it, on the 11 objectives, only one directly refers to maintaining the amenity of adjoining sites. So what I'm saying is, understanding the noise, if you like, or the background noise of a lot of discomfort, but in terms of a framework we're being asked to make decisions on, it seems that the plan, at least in terms of subjects and policies, doesn't seem to be reflecting that issue of scaling it back and balancing it and tempering it to the extent you've verbalised. I'm not suggesting you're wrong. Mm-hmm. It's just about saying perhaps the plan's objectives and policies don't quite reflect that balance that you've heard. We'll see.
Yeah, I think you've also got perhaps the objective 8.2 part about Arrowtown. Responding sensitively to the town's
character. Yeah, uniquely to Arrowtown, that's fair point.
Yeah, so I think...
To be fair, I wasn't really thinking about Arrowtown in this discussion. Arrowtown and historic heritage and intensification and massive change don't actually sit that well in my mind right now. So let's not talk about Arrowtown right now, that's digging another hole.
Yeah, so I think when I think of the medium density zone, it's always the Arrowtowns and the Wanaka ones that come to mind,
yeah,
because they're the ones that we hear the most opposition about. But you're right, there are a number of other areas within the proposed medium density zoning that should definitely be promoted, in terms of the housing, less temporary.
Sure. So in terms of what you just said, and again, scope of sufficiency, we understand. But putting aside the technicalities that you get there, would it make sense that the objectives and policies made a clearer distinction between those areas of the medium density zone that might be much less constrained and those, Arrowtown and Wanaka, where maybe a greater level of limitation or intensification opportunity might exist? It sounds like the whole zone gets dragged down a bit by looking out for two particularly important and contentious areas. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I would agree with you there, and that's what I've thought about overnight, and again, listened to the green evidence from the activities there, because I thought perhaps we could divorce the Wanaka and Arrowtown and perhaps do something slightly differently to the remainder of the zone.
Well, what's something I can understand the minimum site size, sort of, I'm still not. But in light of our discussion yesterday on the low density zone, that doesn't actually have a minimum lot size for intensive housing, subject to compliance with the density requirement. But in parts of this zone, the subdivision standard certainly suggests there should be a minimum lot size. Suggesting if I had a site medium density and right next to it low density, I could possibly achieve an outcome that actually had a higher real density on the low density site in terms of the lot sizes. I could do terrace houses that only had 150 square metres of actual defined lot size, as long as I only had one of them per 300 of my site, so I could keep the back completely vacant. And I talked just about bringing to the front. But in the medium density zone, it would be harder to achieve that level of size. That's how I understand it. And I can understand maybe if there's a restriction of context that might support some form of limitation on site size in, say, Wanaka or Aotearoa. Seems pretty counterintuitive to me that the rest of it would have that site requirement. Notwithstanding, we still have to think what the effect that actually has, because you get a land use consent first and the subdivision requirements for site size don't actually matter. But okay, well, I'll chew on that. Thank you for that.
Just before we go on to a different area, I'd just like to ask whether, in respect of Monica, the submissions on the plan reflect that pressure that you suggested the council felt in the community consultation phase.
I'm only hearing about the community consultation phase we can have.
I understand you're hearing about that, but yeah. You've also read all the submissions. Do the submissions reflect that, or do the submissions from Wanaka are pretty neutral on medium density zone? I'm trying to get a handle on whether there is a certain section of the community that are opposed to it, or whether the whole community is opposed to it.
No, definitely not the whole community. And if we're talking about numbers, it's a small number.
Mm. Okay. So it's allowed?
Yeah, allowed by
the
minority.
So Wanaka may not need separate provisions, given that it has the same difficulty as the affordable housing schemes to some extent.
And there's a few submissions that are saying we don't actually need communities in Wanaka because we don't have a housing problem.
Not what I'm hearing at the moment, but.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Similar. Arrowtown.
Well, Arrowtown is now the most expensive average house price in New Zealand, so one wonders whether. It is true that they don't have a housing problem.
But it's the poor people problem.
Were you going to go on to the major areas?
I was going to dive into the provisions, but I can start now.
I can probably sense we have a break.
Yeah,
we
can talk
about when the Germans are all right. I think it's something.